Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
And we are ready to plunge into, well, quite a stack of material today.
It's good to be here. Yeah, it's quite the snapshot we've got. A whole moment captured, really.
So let's announce it properly for everyone. The Washington Post for Sunday, October 12th, 2025.
And it feels like it captures so much friction, doesn't it? Geopolitics, institutions under stress, and this tech revolution that's genuinely messing with our idea of truth itself. It is a heavy stack.
It really is. But that's our mission here, right? To give you, the listener, that shortcut to being really well-informed. We're going to pull out the key insights, talk about what it all means.
Connect the dots.
Exactly. Across every major story here. We've got global conflicts, local crime, the AI upheaval. It's all in here.
And maybe we should start close to home. Because the level of damage being done to institutions right now, it's pretty stunning.
Yeah.
Let's unpack what's happening at the CDC.
Okay, yeah. That report by Lena H. Sun, it's chilling. The scale of these staff cuts at the Centers for Disease Control, we're talking what? An initial wave of over 1,000 layoff notices.
More than 1,000, yeah. And that's just CDC staff. It's part of this bigger plan the Trump administration mentioned, eliminating around 4,000 government positions because of the shutdown.
But this isn't just, you know, trimming the fat.
Oh, absolutely not. This looks targeted. These cuts went right for the critical nerve centers of the agency. I mean, you're talking about instantly losing huge amounts of institutional memory.
Like those initial notices hitting the leaders of the measles response teams, domestic and international.
Exactly. And think about the specific expertise being lost. There was one official mentioned, over 28 years of experience. We're talking Ebola, Marburg virus, Mpox outbreaks in Africa. Deep, irreplaceable field experience.
Wow, you can't just hire that back next week.
You really can't. It effectively leaves the country much more vulnerable to emerging threats, you know? And it's not just the disease teams. Look at the global operations impact.
Right. The Global Health Center's leadership office described as being wiped out. That sounds incredibly aggressive, affecting all their regional offices worldwide.
Wiped out. That's the phrase used. It basically dissolves the top leadership layer across six global regions.
Mm.
And that cripples the ability to coordinate overseas operations.
Which is where so many threats start.
Precisely. It directly hampers deploying the EIS officers, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, the disease detectives. The CDC's whole success model historically has been about getting those folks on the ground fast at the source of an outbreak, often somewhere remote, to stop it before it gets here. If you take out the central coordination office, well, you've just cut off that capability.
It's like blinding yourself intentionally. And then there are the less flashy but still vital internal parts getting hit too.
Absolutely. The Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics.
Yeah.
They do all that complex modeling, predicting disease spread. Yeah. About 20 people impacted there.
And the CDC library. Gutted. That sounds symbolic almost.
It does. You know, yeah. People might overlook a library, but for researchers needing to synthesize decades of data, it's essential. There was a quote from someone laid off.
Yeah, I saw that. I don't see how any research will be done without a working library. That suggests basic research capacity is just gone.
And think about trust, operational trust. The Office of Safety got hit. These are the people handling mask fit testing for field staff. Testing water systems for Legionnaires' disease inside CDC buildings.
Even the ethics office in HR, vetting conflicts of interest, like for the vaccine advisory panel.
Impacted, yeah. I mean, if the public starts questioning the ethics or the basic safety protocols within the agency, the whole public health mission starts to crumble, doesn't it?
So what's the official line? Why do this?
Well, the HHS spokesman, Andrew Nixon, he used the phrase cutting wasteful and duplicative entities. Said they were at odds with the Make America Healthy Again agenda.
But that doesn't really track with the immediate chaos, does it? If it was so well planned, why did they instantly have to start reversing some of the notices? Admitting errors for the measles team, the global health leaders.
Exactly. This sheer confusion around the final numbers, who's actually laid off, how long reversals will take, it just paints a picture of administrative chaos, not targeted cuts. The agency is basically paralyzed in limbo right now.
And maybe the starkest symbol of it all is suspending the MMWR.
The Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, yeah.
That's the CDC's main way of getting crucial health info out to doctors.
Right, it is. And it had been published continuously, without fail, since 1952.
Wow.
To just pause it, because of an administration order to stop all federal health agencies' external communications, that's a profound hit to timely, reliable information, just when you need it most. arguably.
This is all happening while the government is shut down. But the reporting, like from Paul Kane and others, suggests that this shutdown feels different, less intense.
Yeah, it's weirdly low-key, isn't it? Compared to past shutdowns like the Clinton Medicare fights or Obama and the ACA or even Trump's border wall standoff. This one's been going over 10 days, but there's this sense on Capitol Hill that it's almost
routine,
standard operating procedure.
Yeah, there's a lack of passion, maybe political fatigue. The Senate's closed till Tuesday. The House canceled its legislative session for next week.
It's like that movie, Groundhog Day. Dueling votes that everyone knows will fail.
Yeah.
The GOP plan gets 55 votes, nowhere near the 60 needed.
Predictable failure. Yet the executive branch is making moves. Trump's order on Saturday, directing the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth.
Right, to use repurposed funds to pay military members by October 15th. Citing his commander-in-chief authority, that's a very visible act.
It is, and it ensures military paychecks keep flowing, for now. But it really highlights the disparity, doesn't it?
How so? Well, the military gets this high-profile intervention, but the administration's own budget office confirmed that most other furloughed federal workers, including those essential CDC staff we were just talking about, they're not entitled to back pay under this shutdown.
So it's a strategic choice. Uh-oh. Support a key group, let the rest of the government functions just languish.
Seems that way. It leverages executive power for a specific constituency while the core operations are left hanging.
That instability, it leads us right to the top, doesn't it? From the health of institutions to the actual physical health of the president.
Yeah, let's pivot to that. Dan Diamond and Victoria Craw reported on the note from the White House physician, Sean Barbabella.
Declaring President Trump, who's 79, in excellent health and fit for duty after a checkup at Walter Reed.
A scheduled follow-up evaluation was the term used. The report mentioned strong cardiovascular, pulmonary, neurological performance. All sounds very positive.
Overwhelmingly positive. But there was something unusual included, his cardiac age. Claimed to be 14 years younger than his actual age.
And that specific detail is exactly what's fueling skepticism from outside experts. Why include something so, well, promotional and non-standard? Medical experts like cardiologist Jonathan Reiner and physician Kuhlman, they raised red flags. This was the president's second visit to Walter Reed in just 6 months for a quote-unquote scheduled follow-up.
Okay, that does sound a bit more frequent than routine.
And they questioned the lack of transparency about specific test results. Kuhlman pointed out that for a man of 79 undergoing advanced testing,
what should we expect to see?
Well, best practice would include releasing the results of things like a CT scan of the coronary arteries, you know, to check for plaque buildup. The fact that the White House acknowledged doing advanced imaging and screening, but then, quote, chose not to release those results, that's the issue.
It leaves a vacuum, invites speculation. If everything's truly excellent, why hold back the objective data?
Precisely. It undermines the credibility of the excellent health claim.
Okay, so from the president's physical state, let's look at his use of power. Mark Berman, Emily Davies, Karen DeYoung describe this really dramatic shift, using the military for domestic issues.
Yeah, the focus seems to have swung hard towards targeting violent crime, illegal immigration, and the Antifa movement specifically, and the language being used.
Very warlike, kamikaze attack, war from within.
Which is historically really fraught, right?
Yeah.
Using the military for domestic law enforcement is usually very tightly controlled, legally, and for good reason. What we're seeing looks like an attempt to militarize domestic policy.
But it's hitting roadblocks in the courts.
Stiff resistance, yeah. That's crucial. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago blocked Trump from deploying the National Guard in Illinois. They didn't just question the process. They concluded it was likely to lead to civil unrest.
Wow. So the effect of the deployment was deemed dangerous.
And then in Portland, Oregon, U.S. District Judge Corinne J. Immergut, a Trump appointee, notably, she also blocked troops. Her reasoning was blunt. Trump's justification was, quote, simply untethered to the facts.
So the courts are basically saying, this is political rhetoric, not actual legal necessity for deploying troops domestically.
That's how it reads. But the strategy goes beyond just crime fighting, doesn't it? There was that presidential memo.
Right, aiming to dismantle all stages of organized political violence and domestic terrorism. And it specifically linked violence to anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, anti-Christianity, and, well, anti-Trump sentiment.
This is a really critical development. The White House official tried to draw a line, saying it's about crime, not ideology. But critics argue this massively broadens the definition of domestic terrorism.
To include political opposition.
Potentially, yeah. It implies that if ideological opposition leads to protests or confrontations, it could now fall under this umbrella that justifies more surveillance, more executive action. That's a worrying path for free speech and dissent, you know.
Mm. And then, such a stark contrast, we have the former president, Joe Biden. Yasmina Boutaleb's piece paints a picture of a much quieter life.
A really uneasy adjustment, it sounds like. Back in Wilmington, Delaware, lower profile but still glued to the news, a voracious consumer of news.
That largely out of the public fight.
And dealing with two big things, right? Mm-hmm. His health, that diagnosis of aggressive prostate cancer undergoing radiation and hormone therapy, and his deliberate political silence.
He's not hitting back at the daily attacks from Trump,
yeah.
No.
Despite apparently getting these constant, often baseless, attacks, he's sticking to that old norm where former presidents generally don't engage publicly with their successors.
But that silence doesn't mean things are quiet politically around him. Boutaleb mentions bitterness.
Yeah, bitterness over being pushed out of the 2024 race. And then that really sharp rebuke from his own former VP, Kamala Harris.
In her book excerpts, calling his decision to seek a second term recklessness. Ouch.
That's got to sting. It really fuels that narrative of decline and shows the wounds within the Democratic Party from 2024. They haven't healed, even if Biden himself stays quiet.
Okay, so we've got this backdrop of institutional stress, political fighting, questions about leadership, health, and power. Now let's shift to how technology is mirroring, maybe even amplifying, this chaos into the AI reckoning.
The speed is just incredible. OpenAI's Sora 2, this video generator. Topping the download charts. Why? Because it's fast, and the realism is uncanny.
And that capability immediately brings ethical nightmares.
Instantly. We're seeing this thing Henry Ader calls synthetic resurrection. AI videos of dead celebrities, historical figures, Malcolm X, Kobe Bryant, Bob Ross, Michael Jackson. They're everywhere.
And it's not like respectful documentaries.
No. Often it's for crude jokes, racist memes, or faking traumatic events. The grief it causes the families is immense.
Ilyasa Shabazz, Malcolm X's daughter, her quote was powerful. Seeing her father used for crude humor, calling it deeply disrespectful and hurtful.
And Bernice King, MLK Jr.'s daughter, just pleading, please stop. It forces this question.
Yeah.
Who owns the image, the likeness of someone who's died?
Adria pointed out it's usually not Hollywood doing this with permission. It's S posters, memesters, racists.
Right. And OpenAI's initial stance was problematic. They exempted historical figures from takedowns, citing free expression.
But the backlash was immediate.
And fierce. So they backtracked. Now they say representatives of the recently deceased can request blocks. But that policy is still so murky. Who counts as a representative? How long is recently?
The line between public history and private grief is just dissolving.
And it's not just famous people at risk. Jeffrey Fallow, the tech columnist, his personal story was unsettling.
Deeply unsettling. Friends made deepfakes of him getting a DUI, burning a flag, confessing to eating toenail clippings.
Which sounds absurd, mostly.
Right, until one hit too close to home. A fake video of him telling a slightly off-color joke in a work context. Suddenly, it wasn't funny. It felt plausibly disturbing.
And that's the danger, isn't it? The plausibility. That's the core of what some call an epistemic disaster. The second a fake feels plausible, you lose control over your own story, your reputation. Eva Galperin from EFF made the point. Deepfakes of ordinary people, like high school kids, shown shoplifting or saying slurs, that's way more damaging for vulnerable people who don't have a platform to fight back.
And the supposed safeguards, like watermarks.
Easily defeated. Fowler mentioned you can crop out the Sora watermark in like 5 minutes with basic software like Adobe. So much for transparency.
It really makes you question the motives behind releasing this tech so quickly.
Well, an OpenAI executive, Varun Shetty, basically admitted it. They were permissive initially to avoid a competitive disadvantage. It suggests growth and clicks, even controversial ones like synthetic resurrection, come before ethical checks.
The old move fast and break things model applied to reality itself.
Pretty much. Which leads us neatly into the financial side of AI, right? Lauren Cowery Gurley's piece. The argument is stark.
That AI will remake the world and cause a financial calamity, how can both be true?
Because the build-out is enormous, potentially world-changing. But the current financial structure supporting it looks incredibly fragile and, frankly, kind of artificial. We're seeing echoes of the dot-com bubble.
Especially this idea of round-tripping. Can you break that down? How does that work?
Sure. Round-tripping is basically like the industry buying its own products, to inflate revenue numbers. So you have NVIDIA making the essential AI chips. They invest billions in startups like OpenAI or CoreWeave.
Okay.
Then those startups immediately use that investment money to buy huge amounts of chips and hardware from NVIDIA. Or look at Microsoft, Google, Amazon pouring cash into AI firms like Anthropic.
And a lot of that cash comes right back to them as payment for cloud hosting services.
Exactly. The contracts are often hidden, so it looks like massive organic growth in revenue. But a significant chunk is just money moving in a circle within the ecosystem. It's self-dealing, disguised as market success.
And the sheer scale of this spending, that data point from Neil Dutta was mind-blowing. Capital spending by just a few AI companies contributes more to GDP than all U.S. consumer spending.
It's staggering. That kind of hyper-concentration makes the whole economy incredibly vulnerable if this one sector hits a wall.
Which leads to the skeptics, like Harris Kupperman.
His analysis is pretty brutal. He calculated that just to justify the spending plan for 2025, the AI industry needs to generate something like $480 billion in actual revenue.
And his conclusion?
There just isn't enough revenue. Simple as that. Even huge companies like Alphabet are burning through all their internal cash flow on AI and are now starting to borrow money to fund it. That echoes the unsustainable spending right before the 2000 crash.
It feels like a speculative frenzy. Everyone's caught up in it.
Yeah, investors, the builders, the supposed customers.
Yeah.
It's like that quote, everyone knows that the numbers don't work, but no one knows that everyone knows this. There's this shared delusion, maybe. And the risk, as even Sam Altman hinted, is that when the music stops, a phenomenal amount of money just vanishes.
It's deeply ironic, isn't it? AI is sold as the key to productivity and efficiency.
Yet its initial boom phase seems built on financial engineering and potentially unsustainable hype, creating more instability, not less.
Speaking of instability and human costs, let's shift back to the workplace. That piece by Taylor Telford on the gender pay gap. Really alarming data.
Startling is the word. The pay gap between men and women actually widened 2 years in a row. That hasn't happened since the 1960s.
And the numbers. Women earning just under 81 cents for every dollar a man made in 2024, down from 84 cents in 2022. That's a significant drop.
It is. And the analysis points a big finger at return to office mandates, RTO.
How exactly is RTO driving this reversal?
Well, when big companies like Amazon, AT&T roll back the flexible work arrangements that blossomed during the pandemic, it disproportionately hits women. Why? Because women still shoulder the vast majority of caregiving responsibilities.
And we saw that illustrated with the story of Courtney Clemens.
Yeah, a senior executive forced to choose. When her company mandated RTO, she couldn't make it work with her family needs, so she took a huge pay cut, roughly $30,000, to find a fully remote job.
So RTO isn't just about where you work. It's forcing people, mainly women, to trade career advancement and salary for necessary flexibility.
Exactly. And it's compounded by the insane cost of childcare. It costs more than college tuition in most states now.
So faced with rigid office rules and unaffordable childcare, the options narrow drastically.
Leading women to step back professionally, take lower paying flexible jobs, or leave the workforce altogether. And the data shows it.
The share of working mothers aged 25 to 44 with young kids fell to its lowest level in 3 years, wiping out pandemic era gains.
Dropped almost 3 percentage points just in the first half of this year. It basically erases a lot of the progress made in female labor force participation.
It makes you think when a CEO says flexibility is at odds with the culture.
They're actively choosing a culture that disadvantages caregivers.
Seems that way. Now, interestingly, while that's happening, there's this counter trend Tristan Bove wrote about. White collar unionization is actually on the rise.
In places you wouldn't traditionally expect it, right? Law firms, banks, tech companies.
Mm.
Exactly. It's a real shift. We've seen successful union drives at Wells Fargo, the first major U.S. bank union in decades. And within tech giants like Alphabet, Microsoft's gaming studios.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't factory workers. They're knowledge workers.
So what's pushing them? Is it just about money?
Money's part of it, sure.
Yeah.
But it seems more fundamental. Job security and having a voice. Pearl Cool from the Alphabet Workers Union talked about arbitrary layoffs at Google, creating deep insecurity and mistrust.
And then there's the elephant in the room. AI.
That's the huge driver, especially now. The threat of artificial intelligence, automating entry-level knowledge work, legal research, basic coding, data analysis, it's making people realize they need collective bargaining power.
So they're organizing not just for pay, but to negotiate how AI gets implemented, to have a say in their own potential displacement.
Precisely. labor law experts like Benjamin Sachs at Harvard see unions as becoming essential for knowledge workers to actually address AI's impact. They want a seat at the table to shape how this technology reshapes or maybe even replaces their jobs.
Okay, from these economic and workplace battles, let's turn to the global stage. Starting with the ceasefire in Gaza. Fragile seems to be the word.
Very fragile. It appeared to be holding about a day in after starting noon Friday. But the next few days are absolutely critical.
There are complex steps ahead. Hamas has until Monday, right, to surrender the remaining 48 hostages or the remains.
That's the deadline. And only about 20 of those are thought to still be alive. That handover is the crucial first step.
And in return, Israel is releasing a large number of prisoners.
A very large number. At least 250 Palestinians currently in Israeli prisons. Plus, another 1,722 Gazans who've been held without charge since the October 7th attacks last year. The scale of that second group is staggering.
Alongside this exchange, there's the urgent need for humanitarian aid.
Desperately needed. The plan is for a major surge. The UN aims to get 170,000 metric tons of supplies in over the next 2 months. Food, water, medicine, averaging about 600 trucks a day starting Sunday.
But delivering that aid faces huge hurdles, doesn't it?
Immense hurdles. Israeli troops are still deployed in about half of Gaza. And critically, Israel has banned UNRWA staff and supplies from entering.
UNRWA, that's the main UN agency that's always handled aid logistics there, right?
They're the backbone. Banning them forces them to hand over their massive stockpiles, 5,000 truckloads worth, to other aid groups that are far less equipped and coordinated to handle that scale.
So the aid might be allowed, but the main delivery mechanism is blocked.
Essentially, yes. Aid workers are warning. The guns might be silent, but the suffering won't end without full, rapid humanitarian access. People are reportedly fighting over basics already.
And we saw that immediate human reaction to the pause, people heading back north.
Yeah, those aerial shots showed tens of thousands streaming back towards Gaza City, areas Israeli troops pulled back from, going back to see what's left, retrieve what they can from the rubble. A devastating scene.
Shifting from that conflict to another kind, the U.S.-China trade war is flaring up again. The editorial board called it a fight nobody wants.
Yet both sides seem politically locked into escalating it. It's classic tit for tat. China announced new export curbs on critical rare earth minerals and magnets, adding 5 new elements to the list.
These are materials vital for, well, everything. Laptops, EVs, but also advanced military tech like fighter jets.
Exactly. And Trump's response was immediate and equally tough. New 100% tariffs on Chinese goods, plus more export controls on critical technology going to China.
But the timing is interesting. China's curbs start December 1st, Trump's tariffs November 1st.
It suggests strategic positioning, right? Both sides are planting their flags, taking these really hard-line stances before a planned meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, maximizing leverage before they even sit down.
And China's leverage here is significant because of rare earth.
Immense leverage. They control something like 70% of the world's rare earth mining, but crucially 90% of the processing. The U.S. has deposits, but we depend on China to actually process the stuff into usable forms.
And building up our own processing capacity, that takes time.
A decade or more, realistically. Plus, navigating the cumbersome permitting process here in the U.S. is a major bottleneck. So this trade friction isn't going away quickly.
Okay, let's close the segment with a story that really brings the human cost of conflict into sharp focus. That piece by Lizzie Johnson and Kostyantin Kudov about the family in Ukraine.
Ah, yes. The story of 9-year-old Solomia. Just heartbreaking.
Separated from her mother, Marichka, for over 3 years while living under Russian occupation, finally rescued by her grandmother, Bunya. But the reunion is difficult.
You can see the trauma etched onto Solomia, chewing her fingertips raw, blistered feet from the escape.
Yeah.
She can't even use the bathroom alone now without Bunya, the one stable figure she's had.
And Bunya's journey to rescue her, described as one long, heavy memory, including being turned back by Russian soldiers during an earlier attempt. Terrifying.
But the most gut-wrenching part is Bunya's plan now.
She's not staying.
No. She's planning to go back to live under occupation after Solomia starts school in the fall. Her reason? To give Marichka, the mother, the space and time she needs to learn how to be a mother to this child again. After 3 years apart, under such traumatic circumstances, Bunya could feel she needs to step back to let them heal.
That's an unbelievable sacrifice. Prioritizing their bond over her own safety.
An agonizing choice, but yeah. Profoundly loving, trying to mend the psychological wounds across two generations.
Wow. That really puts the geopolitical squabbles in perspective. Okay, final segment. Let's touch on some cultural notes, local stories, and sports, starting with sad news.
The passing of Diane Keaton at 79. A true icon, an Oscar winner, a rom-com legend.
She really did set the template for the modern romantic comedy lead, didn't she? That natural, slightly awkward, totally charming style.
Absolutely. And her off-screen fashion sense, too. The quirky, androgynous look with the suits and ties. She wasn't your typical Hollywood glamour star.
Won the Oscar for Annie Hall, of course. La-di-da, la-di-da.
Iconic. But also remember her dramatic work like Kay Corleone in the Godfather films? She had range.
And a fascinating personal life. Those famous relationships, Pacino, Allen, Beatty, but she never married, adopted two kids in her 50s. She definitely did things her own way.
A unique figure. Now, on a different cultural note, the Miami Aquarium is closing down.
Right. The county canceled their lease after all those accusations of neglect and violations.
It really signals changing public attitudes towards keeping marine mammals in captivity, especially after reports like that 2022 USDA one. Finding dolphins' food rations were cut by 60% just to make them perform for tourists.
Horrific. Cutting food for the purpose of ensuring the animals perform for guest interactions. Unbelievable. So what happens to the property?
The developer, Terra Group, plans a marina, shops, restaurants, and educational immersive experiences. Importantly, no marine mammals involved, but they are preserving that distinctive geodesic dome structure by Buckminster Fuller.
Okay, shifting gears. A bit of local color from Texas?
Yeah, that British reporter's take on the Texas State Fair was quite amusing.
Contrasting the reserve British fairs with, well, Texas, everything bigger and definitely frighter.
Defined by flame grilled and fried. Mention things like chicken funnel and cotton candy bacon. It's a whole cultural statement via deep fryer.
On a much more somber local note, that explosion in Tennessee.
Devastating. At the Accurate Energetic Systems plant, manufacturing munitions, 16 people killed.
The descriptions of the scene, utter destruction, making the investigation incredibly difficult. Using rapid DNA analysis to identify victims because the debris is so volatile, just awful for the families.
And this plant supplies things like C4 mixture to the military. It's critical work, but clearly dangerous. Apparently, it's not the first deadly explosion there either.
Let's find a positive local note. DC's Advanced Technical Center.
Yeah, a real success story, it seems. A career-focused high school. Lots of dual enrollment for things like EMT, nursing, and 70% of their students completed a pathway last year, way above the city average, showing that kind of focused vocational training really works.
Good to hear. Okay, finally, sports wrap up. WNBA fans need patience.
It's like it. The labor dispute, the CBA battle has gotten too personal, apparently. The deadline is October 31st, and most of the league hits free agency then, so no big player moves until they hammer out a new agreement. The league's kind of stalled.
But baseball delivered some drama.
Oh, yeah. The Seattle Mariners, ending that 24-year drought, finally making it back to the ALCS.
In dramatic fashion, 15 innings. Winner take all game 5 against Detroit.
Polanco with the walk-off hit. Just incredible endurance. Seattle had to use 7 pitchers in that game, including 3 guys who are normally starters. That's digging deep.
What a way to break the streak. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground from this one Sunday paper.
We really have. And looking back across it all, the CDC hollowing out, the RTO battles, reversing gender pay progress, these global trade clashes, the AI identity crisis, the overwhelming theme feels like a failure of existing systems, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A failure to manage complexity, to provide certainty.
Absolutely. And that tension you mentioned earlier between the intensely local and the overwhelming global, it's everywhere. You've got a county in Georgia worried about too many hair salons.
Right, denying a permit due to saturation, hyper-local protectionism.
And on the same pages, the renewed U.S.-China trade war, where global economic power hangs on these tiny, rare earth minerals processed halfway across the world.
The common thread seems to be this dissolution of control. Control over our institutions, control over supply chains, control over, well, over reality itself.
We talked about that epistemic disaster with AI and deepfakes.
Yeah. When the systems we rely on to verify truth start breaking down, it creates fertile ground for conspiracy theories, doesn't it? Because if you can't trust the official story, maybe every story is manipulated.
There was that opinion piece suggesting the online right embraces conspiracies because the old establishment has been largely dethroned. But what happens now? When the new establishment, the tech giants like OpenAI, seem to be actively courting controversy, like with synthetic resurrection, maybe even profiting from the destruction of verifiable content just to grow faster.
That creates a really dangerous feedback loop, I think. The more unstable reality feels, the more appealing these speculative financial bubbles become, like the AI one. And the more likely the whole system, already stressed by political purges, economic uncertainty just faces a sudden, sharp correction. The financial world and the information world are feeding each other's volatility.
So if maybe objective certainty was just a temporary phase in history, and if success in this new AI era seems tied to manufactured chaos, even mass delusion, then what does ownership even mean anymore? Ownership of your face, your history, your country's economy.
That feels like the question, doesn't it? What does ownership mean in this fragmented, uncertain, technologically dissolving environment?
A deep question indeed. And maybe the perfect place to leave it for you, our listener, to ponder further.
A provocative thought to end on. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Thank you, Sam. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back soon with another deep dive.